This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In this hour for Marty Moskowain, the first official day of spring isn't until Sunday, but tell that to Mother Nature. With the very mild temperatures and rains of recent weeks, the Northeast is greening up quickly. And that, of course, includes plants which are unwanted. So this hour, we try to get a jump on things with two experts in studio who can talk about prevention, eradication, different types of weeds, and much more. Scott Geiser is a horticulture educator, recently retired from the Penn State Cooperative Extension in Bucks County. Scott teaches a course in weed science at the Barnes Foundation. Welcome, Scott.
Welcome. Nice to be here.
And Lee Armalay is a landscape designer and project supervisor with Green Weaver Landscapes. Nice to have you here, Lee.
Thank you so much.
Well, I went online and found some sayings about weeds. So let's start off with just a couple. From columnist David Larson, a weed is a plant that has mastered every survival skill except for learning how to grow in rows. Okay. And then there's one most of us have heard. For me, a weed is a plant out of place. That's from botanist Donald Kulross Petey. Scott Geiser, as a horticulturist, where do you fall in your attitude toward weeds?
I guess a good definition is a plant growing where you don't want it, which fits the second description you have. The quote that I often use provocatively with people, I think the philosopher Emerson said, a weed is a plant whose virtues have not yet been discovered. It was him or Thoreau.
And, that's being kind.
Yeah, that'll start a conversation in a hurry, especially if you have poison ivy or crabgrass or a really obnoxious plant. But it does present an interesting point of view.
So, Lee Armalay, what is the damage overall? Give us an overall view of the damage they can do to gardens and lawns.
Oh, it can make quite a problem for a lot of people. I've seen entire properties just completely covered with different invasive species or weeds, and it can just be a nightmare to get started. But there are a lot of ways that we can, both organically or with herbicides, get control back, and it is possible to get control back. So what I like to see, though, is control on individual properties, because we're preventing them then from going into the wild areas where they can cause even more problem, where people aren't managing them quite so regularly.
In essence, weeds can choke the health of the plants you do want.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's start off with invasives. You'd mentioned those. Give us a definition and then tell us why they are so destructive. Scott?
I guess in some sense, you know, any weed is invasive. It's a plant growing where you don't want it. I think today when people speak of invasive plants, they're talking about a smaller subset of plants that have been more recently introduced that really dominate those unmanaged areas.
Introduced from other countries.
From other countries. Mm-hmm. Now, we have to recognize that many of the plants that live in our landscapes have been here for hundreds of years now. I think in the Plants of Pennsylvania, that nice book that University of Pennsylvania put out, there are about 3,000 plants in Pennsylvania species. Mm-hmm. About 1,000 of them weren't here until Europeans came. So the idea of introducing plants or invasive plants is not a new idea, but it's gotten a lot more attention recently as certain plants have really really taken hold in areas and been quite destructive.
Well, I know, Lee, you wrote about burning bush,
yeah,
correct? Which has this gorgeous autumn show but is now banned in New Hampshire and Massachusetts?
It's definitely Massachusetts. I'm not sure about New Hampshire. I typically look at kind of the difference between weeds and invasives as invasive species are ones that really creep out of their existing habit and then like are either moved through birds or through wind or water to these like natural areas that really just take over it to the point that nothing else can grow there. And I have a great picture of like a woodland in Downingtown where in the fall, it's nothing but burning bush in the understory. You can really see that because it's red during that time of year. So there's nothing else growing there except for this understory shrub. And you can see that with multiflora rose or a lot of other, like tend to see it more with woodies. Japanese knotweed's a big one, especially in the city. Where a weed, I tend to think, stays a little bit more locally. It's going to escape out of the way you want it to grow, but it probably isn't leaving the neighborhood. It's probably staying a little bit more local.
Okay, so let's finish tackling invasives to start. Mm-hmm. English ivy, bamboo. The first step is what?
Lee and I were talking before the show. We agree that the ultimate solution is to have so many plants that you do want in a location that there's no room for these other plants. So creating an environment where the plants you want to have dominate is the long-term solution. Now, getting there can be a little bit of a journey, and it may never end, because these plants that are invasive are successful for a reason, and they're not going away. We're not talking about eradicating these plants. They're going to be here forever. They're already successfully established, and so it's a matter of managing them on individual sites.
So if you have English ivy, for instance, which I hear can actually kill a tree, what do you do? Do you have to accept the fact that it's always going to be there in one way, shape, or form, or is it a matter of managing it?
I think there are certain cases, for instance, English ivy, where if you have it on your property and you never want to see it again, you can eradicate it on your property. Whereas other weeds that I'm thinking of, we didn't talk about Japanese stilt grass, but I know you deal with it. Speaking of relatively recently recognized invasives, there's a plant that I would say once it's on your property, you will always have that plant on your property. But English ivy could be managed to eradication.
Yeah, Lee? Kind of going back to the English ivy, that's one that I actually find is because of its growth habit, it's actually a relatively easy one if you have the time and energy to remove. It's relatively easy to remove. You can get out there with a flat-edged shovel and just kind of get underneath the roots and just start rolling it up like a carpet. Just dig out from under the roots and roll it up and shake out the soil. The other important thing to know, and that's why you can't necessarily talk about these invasives as a whole, but English ivy, it grows, it spreads. It's a vine, obviously, but it doesn't really propagate from berry until it starts climbing trees. Once it starts climbing trees, it has the ability to go to flower, go to seed, and then it can start spreading. So if you have limited time and limited resources, the biggest thing is just to keep it from climbing trees, from climbing buildings, from just getting elevated. Once you've got that under control and you want to tackle it on the ground, you can just start, like I said, shoveling it out from underneath and rolling it up.
All right. So let's then take a broader view. Talk about elbow grease, shoveling, digging versus herbicides. What are the pluses and minuses of each? Scott?
Well, I think on a small scale, obviously, this physical removal of the unwanted plant is the way to go. And then we add things like mulches and so forth. And in many cases, just that kind of elbow grease and other good horticulture solves the problem on a small scale. We're probably not going to talk about large-scale agriculture and so forth, but once you get beyond garden size, then the weed game changes dramatically. And my farmer friends that might be listening would say,
it's not going to happen.
Weeds are not a minor problem. They're a major, major issue for production agriculture. Today we're talking about landscapes and gardening and so forth, but I think it's important not to underestimate the extremely destructive power of weeds. But getting back to your question, on a small scale, sure, we use hand pulling and hoeing and mulching, and we succeed most of the time.
Now, with hoeing and even tilling, which goes deeper, I've read that you can actually bring weed seeds up to the surface where they get the sun and the rain that they like. So how do you manage that, Lee?
Typically, if possible, I like to just cut off the weed at the top. And then the biggest thing is to replace what is currently covering the soil with something else. So once you remove the top, or even if you do pull it from the soil and now you have exposed seeds and soil, if we can get that ground covered with either like a mulch or preferably a new plant that's going to take over that space, that would be the best solution. Weeds are opportunistic and they're going to take over any little space they have, but we can prevent those weed seeds from germinating just by getting that ground cover layered.
So you're not a big fan of tilling then to get rid of weeds? Okay. And when you cut a plant from the top, what does that do?
It just removes all of its ability to photosynthesize. It will definitely regrow, but it's just keeping up with that. And in specific instances for really tough to control plants, you may cut it and dab a little bit of herbicide on that open wound.
Of course, you know, in a vegetable garden where we annually plant, we have to disturb the soil. So that's why vegetable gardens are really different than, say, a perennial border in the way we will manage them. So in a vegetable garden, hoeing and hand pulling and disturbing the soil is part of weed control.
So can you plant a certain way in a vegetable garden to minimize the amount of weeds that will come up?
I think you have to recognize in a vegetable garden, because you're always going to, as you say, stir up the soil and expose weeds to a good we fertilize the soil and we do everything to make plants grow well, and then some come up that we don't like. Well, that's just the nature of gardening, And so in a vegetable garden, I think you have to accept weeds as part of the deal, and they're always going to be something that you manage, and you shouldn't be surprised. Whereas in naturalized settings and in perennial borders, then you can work towards minimal soil disturbance, and it's a different scenario altogether.
Let's talk about, just to kind of conclude our conversation about invasives, people have a lot of trouble with bamboo. If a neighbor has bamboo, it spreads like crazy. How can – you've got your hand up, Scott.
My neighbor planted bamboo.
All right. So how do you prevent that from coming onto your property?
Actually, I don't like the plant, and I wish it would, was never brought here. But it's relatively easy to manage by cutting, I have to say.
So you're talking about what Lee was saying, cutting it off.
Just every year in the spring, leafing, as it invades my property, I let it get about 8 feet tall and cut it. And actually, that's it. But I have to say – in one part of the property that I don't get to too much, it is moving in with a vengeance. And so it does require constant attention. And it's a terrible plant in the landscape as far as I'm concerned. But it can be managed in a number of ways.
Can you put a border down?
That's what I was going to say. Okay. Yeah, that kind of comes back to, again, the prevention. I mean, if it's there, it's there. But if we want to prevent it from continuing – they sell different bamboo barrier. It's usually made out of a plastic, and it should, I think, go at least like 30 inches deep. And then you also want to have maybe like an inch hanging above the soil so that the roots and the rhizomes don't climb over it. You know, ideally, the idea would be to not plant the bamboo in the first place, because now you're sticking a piece of plastic in the ground that's going to stay there inevitably until you want to remove it. But that is an option. And I would say if you do really feel like you need to plant bamboo, you should definitely consider putting that bamboo barrier in.
We've got calls coming in already to 888-477-9499. Let's go to Warren in Gwynedd Valley. Hello, Warren.
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, my comment to your expert is if people, when they take their fall leaves to clean up their gardens, can save them and then replace them in the spring back on their beds, they'll be doing themselves two favors. One is that the leaves are full of nutrients, and second is they, by covering the bare soil, they'll be preventing the bulk of where weed seeds come from, which is when soil is disturbed and uncovered and sunlight's able to get to it.
Warren, thanks for the call. I'm sorry. I have to stop you there because we're coming up against a break. You're nodding your head, Scott?
Mulches are great, but you have to recognize with some weeds that have big energy reserves underground, Canada thistle and so forth, they'll grow right through that mulch. Mulching is great, good comment, but won't always work.
If you mulch, how deep?
3 inches.
Yeah, for leaf mulch, I would go a little bit heavier, but 2 to 3 inches.
Yeah. Okay, our focus this hour is on the weeds, which, excuse me, drive us crazy. If you've got questions or comments, 888-477-9499 is the number. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Maybe a little pollen there for me. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking weeds this hour. The population is probably about to explode as spring arrives. We've had some warm weather, we've had rain, and it's a recipe, of course, that weeds just love. So here to answer our questions, horticulture educator Scott Geiser and landscape designer Lee Armalay. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. We take an email as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So just briefly, let's get back to that vegetable garden we were talking about a couple moments ago. You've chosen your plants. You're just about to get started. How can you prep that garden to keep the weed level as low as possible? Lee, what are some thoughts?
To keep the weed level as low as possible, like I think like Scott mentioned earlier, we do just have to accept that there is a number of weeds that are going to occur. It's just going to happen. I do like to put down a mulch layer, but you want to keep it away from the base of your plants. Straw can be a really good one because it doesn't really hold the water the way like a shredded hardwood or a leaf mulch would. But typically, I would just put something like that down and then know that there are going to be some weeds. I'm not a big fan of the weed barrier fabrics. I tend to find that weeds just kind of grow on top of it and can be kind of problematic.
How about plastics? newspapers?
Well, for plants that really like warm soil, tomato, eggplant, peppers, and the vine crops, many times black plastic is used because it heats the soil. It also provides fantastic weed control. So that's a possibility. I think when beginning gardeners are often indignant about these plants that grow up around what they intended to grow. And when we talk about weed science in introductory lectures, there are some amazing weed facts that may help people understand where these weeds are coming from. A very common weed in vegetable gardens is red root pigweed. The plant scientists tell us one plant can produce 100,000 seeds.
Wow.
So you've got that idea. Weed scientists also do interesting experiments and have done them where they bury weed seed and then every year for decades dig it up and see if it's still viable. Red root pigweed will last for 40 years in the soil. Many common annual weeds have that ability. So when you put those two things together, tremendous seed production and longevity of the seed, gardeners should never expect that their gardens are going to be weed-free from annual weeds that produce seed. And then there are perennial weeds that are lurking underground, and they're a different story altogether.
And yet we want to reduce some of the workload. We're busy. We don't want to be out weeding constantly.
Yeah. Well, mulches, and I would say in a vegetable garden in particular, find a hoe that you really like and maybe three or four different kinds of hand tools. I must have a dozen. And use the one that you like best and do it every day. Weeding in a garden, I think, is an everyday activity.
How do you make it a palatable activity?
Just accept that it's an interesting thing. Learn to identify the plants that are out there. Think about them. And weeding can be it doesn't have to be drudgery, I'd put it that way.
It's easier after a good rain, too.
Yeah, sure.
Just keeping up with the frequency of it, we use a tool called a scuffle hoe that can be really effective, and that is great for when the weeds are just really young and small, but they're young and small only for a short period of time. So if you go out there once or twice a week and just knock off those little weeds from getting started, you're ahead of the curve at that point. But if you go away on vacation for a week or let it go for just far too long, those weeds are up and they're a lot larger, so it's harder to control.
It's amazing how fast they can grow. I've read also that watering, if you have an irrigation system in, that can be a way of discouraging weed growth. But yet to a novice gardener, it's a little intimidating, the thought of trying to implement a system like that. Do you agree?
I don't like irrigation systems. Most horticulturists I know don't, because they don't operate the way you want them to, and overwatering is a major problem. And I don't see any way that managing water is going to discourage weeds.
So if you don't run a soaker hose underneath a row of say vegetable plants, that's just not going. It's going to benefit the plants, not necessarily feed the weeds.
I get your idea there. Yeah. Yes, if you only put the water where the crop plant will benefit, yes, that's good, as opposed to watering the whole garden. Sure, yeah, that's a good idea. But automatic systems in particular fail and are expensive and complicated, and for most gardeners, they're not a great idea.
Well, how do you like to water?
I like to collect rainwater and use that back in my garden, especially if it's not close enough to pulling out the hose all the time. A lot of times that can just be kind of cumbersome, and then it discourages you from using it. But if you can set up a rain barrel nearby or something like that, even if you're just collecting water from that surface area, it can oftentimes be enough to just keep your plants watered. It depends how extensive your garden is, I guess, part of it.
Yeah, and really large vegetable gardens, and I know some of the listeners probably have them, a trickle irrigation system is a wonderful thing. Mm. I think the other thought that went through my mind is, if you don't really enjoy being in your garden, what are you doing gardening? So watering is a wonderful way to look at what's going on and think about whatever you want to and enjoy the whole experience. And that includes pulling weeds.
I was just going to say, you might look at it that way, too, as far as weeds are concerned. All right. Let's get to the telephones. Laura in Southwest Philly joins us now on Radio Times. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm one of the few that find weeding very therapeutic. I think some green options for controlling weeds might be some hybrid plants, as such as I have as hybrid bamboo, or possibly removing the grass and putting down some thick landscape fabric with a 3/8 tipple, red tipple, or some bee gravel. And the other thing is, people are using goats, which is another very green way to manage unwanted grass and weeds in the garden. Unfortunately, my township doesn't allow it, but I'm hoping it will catch on and become a more popular source source for controlling weeds.
So, Laura, you have two interesting points. A hybrid bamboo, what is that exactly?
I don't know. Botanically, I don't know if it's a cross between two plants, but it does not grow. It's not invasive like bamboo. It doesn't spread, and it reaches a certain height, and that's it.
Okay. And so a hybrid bamboo, have either of you heard of that? Is that an alternative?
Yeah, I have a customer with that on his site, and I can speak to it. It does stay relatively in its area. It stays a lot shorter. So that is a nice alternative. A lot of times people want the regular bamboo because they want the height. This hybrid variety or cultivar, I'm not sure what it is a lot lower. I think it only maxes out at maybe 4 or 5 feet. And then goats was the other thing she was talking about. I don't know that goats are very effective for residential properties. I think that they're very effective on campuses, on industrial sites, on just large spans of land that need control. But I don't know how feasible it is if you want to grow desirable plants to also have the goats there controlling invasive plants.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Laura. I've heard that they like poison ivy, and they can actually eat it, and they're not affected by the oil that's in poison ivy. So you're nodding your heads. That's a fact.
I've had people tell me that they go to, and I've seen the effects, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the poisons for a moment. Ivy, oak, and sumac. Leaves of three, let it be, is the old adage, but really a lot of plants have leaves of three. How do you recognize poison ivy? Best way?
As you say, a good starting point is there are three leaves. They're quite shiny, and as the plant ages, it gets a rope-like stem that's very distinctive. Poison oak, I have never seen in my life. Have you seen it?
I don't know that we have poison oak and poison sumac in this area very readily.
Yeah, so
it's primarily poison ivy.
Yes. Yeah, poison ivy is our major problem, and I guess a couple of bad experiences, and then you learn to identify it really well. And the plant looks different depending where it's growing, but can grow up trees. The shiny three leaflets is a really good starting point. I've got a good weed identification book, in fact, a couple of them, and people will readily find images of poison ivy, and it's not hard to identify.
So weeds in the Northeast, you're holding that up?
For people that really like the subject of weeds, Weeds of the Northeast is pretty much recognized as the go-to book. It costs about $30. The people at Cornell University wrote it, and it has about 300 weeds that are very common in the Delaware Valley, and it's a great book for weed identification if you care to know their names.
Well, I know I've had issues in New Jersey where I live with poison ivy. It's really hard to get rid of. What is the first thing that you do to think about to get rid of this plant?
To me, it's one of those things where it's kind of the plant that you don't want to touch. You don't want to bother with it. But while it's small, it's going to be the easiest time to approach it and attack it. Just wearing layers of gloves, long sleeves. Unfortunately, every time we end up having to do poison ivy control, ends up being the hottest day of the year. But really, you want to keep those long sleeves on, have long gloves on, and black plastic trash bags without any holes in it. And then just pull the small plants. You can cut the tops of the larger plants off and just let them be there. Let them decay on the trees or wherever they're growing. And then that is one that, because I don't want it to come back, I will dab a little bit of herbicide on that cut so that it takes it down to the root system and discourages it from just popping up in other areas. I do want to note, though, that poison ivy is a native plant that has a lot of benefit to birds. So as Scott kind of mentioned earlier in the program that, we don't always know what the function of these plants are.
Sure.
Is that poison ivy is really beneficial for a lot of our birds and the berries specifically. So in more natural areas, I don't mind letting it grow and keep growing. But I do totally recognize that in our home landscapes, we don't want us touching it. We don't want our kids or our pets touching it. So it is really important to remove it there.
So I've also read some things some big don'ts as far as poison ivy is concerned. Do not use a weed whacker on poisonous plants. Obviously, we'll spray the sap all around. And don't burn it.
Right.
I didn't realize that. You can actually release, let me see if I'm pronouncing this correctly, urushiol, the name of the oil, that can be released into the air.
Yeah. It can be really irritating for your eyes and for your throat. It can kind of get inside of your body as well. So you don't want to do that.
I would note that is a plant where herbicides are extremely effective. Some people choose to use them and some not, but they're very effective herbicides for poison ivy control. They just flat out work.
And quickly before we get back to the phones, what's the best way to dispose of it? Wrap it in a trash bag, chuck it, or?
I would wrap it in a trash bag and chuck it. I don't think I would compost that one.
Yeah, if you kill it with an herbicide, it dies in place and you don't do anything. Spray it and walk away.
Okay. Eric in Bucks County has called in. Eric, you're live on Radio Times. Hello.
Good morning. I got a problem that a lot of people in Bucks County are having now, and I'm worried about it because it's basically destroying my property. I live in 3 acres in a wooded area with a creek. Anybody up in Bucks County who lives in that same kind of situation is having this problem. Lesser salandine is basically taking over my property and destroying all my grass, and there's no way to fight it, and I haven't heard any good news about it, and nobody really wants to talk about it. I'd be interested in hearing your opinion.
Well, you've come to the right place, Eric. So you're both nodding your heads. Lee?
Yes, that's one that I feel your pain, Eric. We're all dealing with that. There isn't really a great way to control it so far that I've seen. We are working with some herbicides to control it, especially when it's young. You can try digging it out, but it seems to creep in, and I don't even know how it's getting there some of the times. So I don't know if it's squirrels or if something's physically moving the little bulblets up, but it's been really tough for us as well. I'm sorry, I don't have a great solution.
If Scott? People don't know that plant, if you look into a wet area, stream or river bed at this time of year and you see a solid green carpet with beautiful little yellow flowers, you're looking at lesser celandine. And it's what's called a spring ephemeral because it emerges really early, it really dominates the site, and then it fades away naturally. The problem is it's so dominant that it will absolutely outcompete any other spring ephemeral or anything else that wants to grow in the area. And I recognize what the caller talks about. There are probably some chemical solutions, but we probably ought to have a longer conversation about some do's and don'ts if you were to go that route.
Any good research sources for Eric?
I don't know anybody that's written anything recently on lesser celandine. You can obviously find good stuff on the internet about identification and so forth. But, it's a problem, and I think it's a weed problem that's getting bigger each year, especially in the Delaware Valley.
Eric, thanks for the call to Radio Time. Sorry it was such a tough one. All right, on to Anna in Easton, Pennsylvania. She's got a question about Japanese stiltgrass. Hi, Anna.
Yes, I have lots of Japanese stiltgrass in my lawn, especially. When it's in my flower beds, I pull it, and they say, or I've heard them say, that the best thing to do is to pull it. But in the lawn, it's overwhelming. I had my family out there pulling this stuff, and they weren't very happy with me. And, you know, then the next year it all comes back because it comes back from seed each year. So what is the best way to control this in my lawn?
I would say just think of it like crabgrass. It's almost identical to crabgrass in its life cycle and so forth. So it's what we call a summer annual grass. It germinates in the spring. It grows like crazy in the summer, dies with the first frost. As Lee said earlier, and we agreed, the ultimate goal is to have so much good lawn grass present that stilt grass doesn't have a place to grow. So it really comes down to very sound management to make your cool season lawn grasses outcompeted. So you just end up managing stilt grass like you manage crabgrass. A lot of that's good fertilization, good mowing practices, good overall soil health. You can add in the herbicidal components if you choose to, and they're very effective.
Thanks, Anna, for the call to Radio Time. So what grasses do you like for the Delaware Valley?
I would say a seed mix that has many different types of species in it is going to be the strongest. Whenever we end up with a monoculture, there's always the risk for disease or for something to compete with it. So in some shadier sites, we like to use some of the tall fescue or some of the fine fescues. Typically, the long grasses that we're using in this area are a mix of tall fescues. Yes, tall fescues with some rye and bluegrass.
Yeah, the problem with stilt grass is it's very shade tolerant. And if people don't know that weed, just drive on any of the shady roads in the Delaware Valley, and that green fringe along the road in the summertime is almost certainly Japanese stilt grass. Deer don't eat it, and so it proliferates, and it's very shade tolerant. So in a lawn setting, if you have a shady lawn, you really have to go towards those shade tolerant grasses. Maybe have a lot more of the shade tolerant species in the mix, and then be sure you fertilize them and establish them at the right time so they can outcompete the stilt grass.
So how do you know if you have good soil?
Good soil is a funny term. It really depends on what you're trying to grow and a number of different characteristics. So you may have a technically good soil from a nutrient perspective, but it may be compacted or it may be waterlogged. So there are different ways that you might consider having a good soil. I like to see some organic matter in that. So especially in a lawn setting, I think a lot of our lawns are lacking because so many people take the clippings and they haul them away, and we're never putting that nutrient back. And then the leaves fall and we take those away as well. So our lawns are always being depleted.
So Lee, you're saying leave the clippings.
Absolutely, yeah.
Leave the leaves?
Leave the leaves to a certain extent. I mean, we don't want to smother the grass, but we do want to use like a mulching blade, chop those, let them settle down the lawn. There will be a few leaves on your lawn, but it will really kind of support the lawn in the long term.
Easier for an awful lot of us in the fall.
Exactly. Yeah, it really is. It's a lot. You're saving your weekends, and it's a lot less or a lot better for your lawns.
So when you say if you were to take a handful of soil and you were to eyeball it, what are you looking for? Are you looking for earthworms? Are you looking for a certain texture? I mean, Lee, you mentioned you didn't want it to be compacted necessarily. Mm-hmm. What's a good, healthy handful of soil look like?
Well, as Lee said, organic matter is probably the quality that we can manipulate with the biggest effect.
So you're talking about organic matter in that handful. What is that? Are you talking about like dead leaves and clippings and
it's
stuff?
It's decayed things that were once living. Some of them are ancient. Some of them are relatively recent. And preserving what you've got or even importing and top dressing a lawn with organic matter is a really good practice. But, you know, plants are very forgiving and can live under many soil conditions. So I don't think you have to have perfect soil. You just have to match plants to the site you have.
Okay. Weeds, the focus of this hour of Radio Times. 888-477-9499 is the number. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. More just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. Our guests are Lee Armalay, a landscape designer, and horticulture educator Scott Geiser. And we're talking about weeds. And off mic, Scott, you had said that a lawn could be a pretty low maintenance ground cover. And so many of us, it seems, love the green carpet effect. The two don't go together necessarily.
Yeah, and lawns can range from extremely manicured, immaculate, emerald green, solid monostands of one species on the one hand to a fairly weedy green thing out there that most of us have. but if you have large areas that need to be managed, mowing them periodically, mowing grasses that tolerate low mowing results in a green ground cover that has a lot of environmental benefits. Lawns have, I think, taken a little bit of a beating lately in certain places because of the inputs that are sometimes used. We have to mow them, and we do have to fertilize them to maintain some density. But all in all, in my book, if it's not overdone, it's a very acceptable, relatively low-maintenance ground cover on a large scale.
Well, we talked about leaving grass clippings and leaves. What other fertilizer do you like?
Anything that can provide just the right amount of nutrition to give the grass a decent chance to be competitive. So with no nitrogen input, that element nitrogen, lawns tend to get so thin that become more weeds than grass. So somehow you need to get some fertility to the turf. And there are many organic options there these days. And by returning the organic matter in the form of clippings and tree leaves, we continue to recycle nitrogen that's already been put in place.
Let's talk about some weeds that we might want to keep in lawns. I've read that clover can actually pull nitrogen out of the air and put it into the soil. Is that right, Lee?
Yeah. Clover has a really great property that its root system is able to, they call it fixed nitrogen, and that helps grow it well. But the problem is that a lot of people, like, you don't see clover in golf courses, and most people are trying to achieve that golf course look. So they don't like that there's a broad leaf in their lawn, that there's possibly flowers and bees flying around. However, I think it's a really attractive look, and knowing that it's cutting down on inputs is really helpful. I don't know that there are that many other weeds that are desirable in the lawn to help fertilize it. But I do think that, personally, I like violets in the lawn. I think that they're really attractive. It's just kind of what your aesthetic is.
Yeah. Every spring I get tons of these little white and purple violets sprinkled all through the lawn. Yeah. And somebody told me that was a weed once.
It depends who's making the judgment. And I feel that way about dandelions. I know they can get horrendously out of control. But if dandelions didn't exist today and someone could introduce a little bright yellow flower that would liven up your lawn, I'll bet it would be the hottest new perennial on the market.
Mm. All right, back to the phones we go. Dolores in Wilmington, Delaware. Welcome to Radio Times, Dolores.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I regard, as the last speaker hinted, as having a meadow in my front yard. It's a combination of weeds and various kinds. And I think having one of those lawns that look fully grassy, and they look good in the pictures and the advertisements, but I think it's a mere convention. And why are we continuing an unnecessary convention?
Interesting question, Lee.
I think part of it is, I think it started a long time ago in the 60s. It was really a point of pride on how well you took care of your property. And unfortunately, a lot of that's changed. Not that it's changed. It's just that we don't have the same point of pride necessarily, or we're trying to, but we don't have the same desire to put the inputs that used to be done. I actually really love that look of meadows in yards. There are a couple areas that I drive around regularly through Chester County where a lot of the neighborhood has chosen to move into meadows. And to me, it really depends on the aesthetic, but I drive around that area and it looks much more rich and full to me. And I think that those people seem like they are caring for their lawn or their properties more than the people who have the lawns. And I'm not anti-lawn. I love a lawn to run around in with bare feet. I think that it's a wonderful thing, but I do agree that meadows can be a really interesting look. And it's different, and I think that's kind of interesting now.
Dolores, thanks for the call to Radio Times. The next question, though, is how do you cultivate a meadow that your neighbors are happy with? Scott?
Well, I think that can be a challenge because obviously a meadow is very different than a lawn that's cut at an inch and a half. But in areas that are managed less intensively, and I just popped into my mind, Valley Forge Park, which I used to drive through all the time, used to be mowed probably 20 times a year. Not too long ago, they went to a totally different management program. Now it gets a couple mowings a year. It achieves the exact same effect with fewer inputs and probably has more plant diversity and so forth. The one problem with meadows that I've seen, and Lee, I hope you can speak to this more, folks have the idea that, well, I'll just plant what I like and then I'll sit back and enjoy it. And what happens is they become totally infested with these invasive and noxious plants. And people are disappointed. I think a meadow is more difficult than most people think to achieve.
Yeah. Well, with a meadow, you're thinking of native plants, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and so there are a couple different styles of meadow. I think that a native warm season grass meadow with wildflowers that can be a little bit trickier to get started. And then it's funny because I come from more of like the residential sector, and everybody asks for a no-maintenance landscape. And I've really honestly never seen a no-maintenance landscape. If you don't maintain it, something will come in. And same is true for a native warm season grass meadow. You have trees that can move in and vines and other invasive problems.
Sure.
I think a nice, cost-effective and easy kind of way to meet in between is to just release turf grass. Sometimes you will get some wildflowers that will move in. And when I say release turf grass, I just mean to stop mowing it. Maybe mow it a couple of times a year. But to go back so that people don't think that it's a weedy mess, there are certain ways that you can kind of maintain this stuff so that we call them cues of care, by putting a mow strip around the edge of this area, whether it's released turf grass or a warm season grass meadow, or like little fence indicators, or if you're not in a residential setting, putting up signs that say this is a meadow. So by indicating that it's cared for, I think it's more attractive to more people.
And let's talk about weeds or, you know, plants that are in the wrong place that you might want to have on your landscape. For instance, they're beneficial to bees and to butterflies. I mean, bee populations have taken a beating in recent decades. Are there any plants that we want to leave in place to help bees recover?
I often say that my favorite wildflower book is my weed book because there's just tremendous crossover there. And so, again, going back to the definition of what is a weed, it's a plant growing where you don't want it. But if you want to invite lots of wildlife to your property, have lots of weeds and you'll get them. And there are absolutely benefits to pollinators to have a lot of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of information on the internet these days from very credible sources that talk about specific relationships between certain plants and certain insects. And there are a lot of people having fun with that, and your yard becomes more of a butterfly and bee habitat than that green carpet that you used to have.
Well, for instance, I read that milkweed is on the rise in the South, and that's helped the monarch butterfly to recover. So, and that actually some former weeds have caught the attention of the nursery industry, like swamp milkweed.
Yeah. A lot of these we're seeing available in the trade for people to purchase and plant. And I think that depending on the style of landscape you are trying to cultivate, these can be really attractive plants in your garden. I really love the swamp milkweed. It does fairly well in regular garden soil as well as swampy soils. So that can be a really great plant to use. Butterfly weed is another one that's an Asclepias and a milkweed. That is a really pretty orange one that's great for dry sites, so we can help the butterflies that way. But basically, we don't have to just let the weeds be free to support the butterflies and the bees. We can allow garden space that is well designed and fully planted with a variety of different plants, and that will help support our bees and our butterflies as well.
All right, more telephone calls to Radio Times. Barbara in Zionsville, you're live. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I have a bamboo question.
Okay.
I've got the, the tall kind, and I've cut it down every year, or I try to clear it out and prevent the new growth by cutting it. But last fall, I decided to get rid of it entirely. So we cut it down with the chainsaw, got rid of it, and then put heavy carpeting down on top of it. And I'm wondering if that will get rid of it.
I don't think so. No, it's going to grow right through there. I'm afraid you need to physically remove it with some heavy equipment. It will grow through almost anything.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I would agree. It's a really difficult to control plant, and just covering it isn't always going to help.
All right, Barbara, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. Over to Williamstown, New Jersey, and Barry, welcome.
Hi. It's funny, I'm pulling weeds in the garlic as we speak, but...
How's the weather?
One of the things that, as a certified organic grower, I use, and a lot, it's kind of underutilized, and I'm not speaking to lawns as much, but maybe for people's vegetable gardens, is people don't think about cover cropping. In between rows of vegetables, maybe especially like once you start tearing out plants at the end of the season, it's August, you know, your tomatoes going bad and you're starting to pull them out. Simple things like putting down rye grain and hairy vetch, for instance, in the fall, or else in the summer, a quick crop of buckwheat that can help provide beneficial insects, flowering and nectar and stuff like that, but as well as also really just crowds out the weeds. And I can take any comments off the air.
Thanks, Tom. So what do you think of cover crops as weed preventers?
It goes back to that idea that if plants that you want to have dominate the site, you don't have weeds. And so my raised bed garden now is half full of rye that was seeded in the fall. There's not a single weed in it, and I'm getting other benefits as well. So absolutely, cover crops are great. They work in vegetable gardens. Some beginning gardeners wonder, how can I grow alfalfa in my perennial bed to have a cover crop? And they don't really fit that scenario. Mm. They're great for the vegetable garden, and there are lots of cover crops to consider.
So let's talk about some non-chemical alternatives. What do you think about herbicidal soaps? Do they work on weeds that you do not want?
I'm not as familiar with herbicidal soaps. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with like an insecticidal soap where mm-hmm. it covers the body of the insect and mm-hmm. it can't breathe. I'm not as familiar with herbicidal soaps.
They're weak in the weed world, in the herbicide world, they would be considered weak contact herbicides. And so herbicidal soaps will desiccate the foliage that they're applied to, and they're like chemical mowing.
Are they a little more environmentally friendly?
Actually, the only herbicidal soap I know is not organically approved and is has higher toxicity than most people would believe.
Mm.
So herbicidal soaps, I don't see, organic folks can't use them, the one that I'm aware of that's on the market. Now, there are things like vinegar and clove oil and garlic oil and so forth. And
do they work?
They're very, very weak herbicides. And I think the comment I'd make there is people think they can take something like that because it's sold and says it kills weeds, and they can control things like poison ivy and bamboo and Canada thistle, and they're almost completely worthless in that scenario. They can kill very small emerged annual weeds, but you can do that a lot of other ways. So I don't really see where they fit.
I would just comment on that also. I completely agree. I think that a lot of people they just want a simple replacement for something that is chemical. And that really doesn't exist. It's really changing the way that we're going about this. And although vinegar is organic, I get really concerned with what that strong acid is doing to the soil biology. And are we making a worse scenario for plants to grow in the future? So I don't think that I don't think you can just replace one chemical with an organic substitute. A lot of times it's changing the way that we do things.
I agree 100%. I think organic gardeners and beginning gardeners that look to those solutions are barking up the wrong tree. Just become a better gardener.
Agreed.
Okay, we've got time, I think, for one more call. So let's welcome Sue to Radio Time, Sue's in Bucks County. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine,
thank
you.
Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to bring something new to the conversation as far as vegetable and sunflower gardening that a lot of people are not aware of, which is hay bale gardening. I learned about this some years ago. I have some physical issues which kind of precluded me spending a lot of time in the sun or doing a lot of physical work. And I was very sad at having to give up gardening and learned about straw bale gardening online, which is very popular in some areas. And when I studied it, I learned that you could also do it with hay bales, and it was much more advantageous because the hay is much better at holding moisture and it has a lot of nutrients.
So, Sue, quickly, since we're up against the clock, what exactly is hay bale gardening?
Well, hay bale gardening is planting your garden in hay bales. You treat the bales, you soak them in water for a month, and then you treat them with the urea to start them composting. So it burns off any of the weed seeds in the hay, and it starts the breakdown of the bale. And you just pull a little pocket in the bales and put your plant right in there. And it is an incredible way to garden if you have poor soil or if you have drainage problems in your soil. Or if you could do this from a wheelchair, you could do it in the back of your truck if you had to.
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Time, Sue. Quick thoughts? Hay bale gardening?
I understand it in theory. I haven't done it myself. The idea is that the hay bale is your growing medium and container all in one. I think the fertility management in that setting is a little tricky, but probably worth a try, especially, say, in an urban setting. Why not give it a try and with some experience maybe could be very successful.
All right, very quickly, any plans for your garden? Said it here, close to the end of March.
Oh, I'm out there every day finding something to do. I don't know.
Vegetables, getting something in. Peas, lettuces?
Yeah, my peas are planted. Garlic's up. Got to turn over those cover crops because they're getting out of control. But, it's a nice year to be in the garden.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Scott Geiser. Great to have you here. Scott is a horticulture educator and teaches a course in weed science at the Barnes Foundation. And Lee Armalay is a landscape designer and project supervisor with Greenweaver Landscapes. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And as always, we invite you to check out our Facebook page and podcast. You can find them at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler. And our intern is Nick Kowalski. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks so much for joining us.